Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 50 of Season 10 of Movie Our Minute Daily Podcast, where we hijack our way through the 1974 action thriller, The Taking of Pelham 123, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again to finish off this week is Dave Anderson of the Free Kittens Movie Guide. Welcome back to the show once again, Dave.
Thank you. It's good to be back one more time to wrap things up for these 5 minutes.
Minute 50 begins with Blue continuing his debriefing of the hostages and ends with machines counting money. I guess that's the best way to describe it.
Yeah.
So we left things off yesterday with Mr. Blue finally getting what he wants. And for some strange reason, he decides to explain things to the hostages. I'm actually a little shocked about it because it doesn't make that much sense for them to be doing something like this. I mean, unless they're trying to give us a little bit of exposition, but you know, someone who's supposed to be this ruthless, a mercenary or whatever. It's just strange that he feels the need to share.
Yeah. Well, maybe by telling the passengers, it helps a little assure that things will continue to go smoothly because maybe none of them will try to do something heroic or act out or, you know, do something that would thwart his plans.
True. But again, it's just... I don't know. For some reason, to in my mind, it just doesn't make sense for him to do something like this.
Or maybe it's a form of him kind of gloating a little bit that they are going to give in, and he wanted to share the fact that in his eyes, he was going to win this standoff.
Maybe.
Because he does seem kind of confident when he says that.
Yeah.
Really confident, in fact.
I think overly confident about the whole thing.
For sure.
But again, he's got this foolproof plan that doesn't involve hide and seek, so it's just a little strange. So he continues talking to the passengers and goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, it might..." And that's what he said yesterday, and then he continues today by saying, "Interest you to know, the city of New York has agreed to pay for your release." And the hostages are cheering. Again, I don't really know why they're cheering. it's a strange situation. You rarely see in like a movie dealing with a hijacking or something like that, where the passengers are cheering when they're getting information from the hijacker. You know, because like, do you believe everything they say?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. And then
maybe the passengers have never seen that movie, those movies.
Apparently. And then the mother shouts out, and says, "As soon as the money gets here, will you let us go?" And he goes, "Soon after." Again, would you really trust someone to give you the true answer to that? Yeah, I'm not really sure about that. And then the old man, who he's one of my favorite characters because of the way that he's played throughout here. And I'm always shocked at the fact that he's actually the actor who plays him is only 60. Would you believe that?
Mm-hmm.
You would.
He seems so much older.
That's my point. He seems much older than that. And he goes, "Excuse me, sir. Would you mind telling us how much you're getting?" And Blue then turns to him and goes, "Why is it of interest to you, sir?" "Well, a person likes to know his worth." He goes, $1 million. And like, Blue is happy to say this. And the old man goes, "That's not so terrific." Because if you split $1 million between, 17 passengers, it's not a very high number of how much each of them is worth. I don't know. I don't know if I would feel offended if I was in that situation. Would you?
Well, taken in the context of the 70s, I mean,
Let's put it this way. In the 70s, that's about $59,000 a person. Okay,
that's true. That's.
today you multiply that by about six.
I suppose I might be disappointed that that's all they were getting for,
So if someone were to say
you
that
know.
you are now worth $353,000, you say that's not that's not impressive.
I don't know. I wouldn't put that to a vote, but
No, I don't know. It's just it's a strange thing for the character to say that's not so terrific. Like, why the hell do you care how much you're actually there? You know, you want the ransom to be as low as possible, so that there's more of a
it
chance that
seems
someone's going to be paying it.
it seems like a paltry amount of money. And yeah, I would definitely for sure want the ransom to be low because it can be realistically fulfilled, especially in the amount of time given.
Well, they don't necessarily know about the time factor here.
No, I'm thinking about actually Mr. Blue's motivation for that
For only
particular
asking
amount
for
now.
that. Okay.
So I guess
Right.
as a passenger, I'd feel a little bit offended, I suppose. But from Blue's perspective, I think he's played the scenario out in his head, and this goes back to when he tells Garber, "You'd be surprised what you can do in 26 minutes." It's almost like Mr. Blue kind of had it figured out that, yeah, $1 million is feasible in that amount of time.
Yeah, but
It's hard, but
he didn't know how long it would take them to make the decision.
that's true. That's true.
You know, it's not like he said, okay, you have till, 2:47 to tell me your answer, and then after that then you have 26 minutes, which will be plenty of time. You know, it's not okay, get on the phone to the mayor and have the mayor have his conversation with all his underlings and then figure it out. You know, that type of thing. So yeah, I
Yeah.
don't know. Again, this I've mentioned this many times. This the whole concept here of asking for $1 million just reminds me a little too much about Austin Powers.
I knew you were going to say that next. I
I've
knew you
said
were going to bring up Austin.
it. I've said it numerous times, but it's because it just doesn't make, from looking at it from our perspective, $1 million is not a lot to ask for in ransom. But obviously at the time it was.
Yeah. And
So
then split four ways.
at
So
least, right. You'd think
it's
also the amount of effort and they're putting into this, getting a quarter of a million is probably not enough. Maybe for Mr. Green, but I think all the others, they'd want more for what more for what they're doing here.
they'd want more for what they're doing unless they're just looking at this like another job until the next one comes along.
Right.
Because I agree. For Mr. Green, this solves all of his problems. The other ones, this is just another risky job. I imagine that Mr. Blue would go back to being a mercenary again if the market, dictated it. This is to tie them over till the next job.
Right.
Yeah, these guys aren't done being criminals after this.
No, I don't believe so at all. I don't believe so at all. And then the shot changes, and basically the second half of this minute is just we get the great David Shire music here, as we get a shot of a police car waiting with four motorcycle cops around them, and we see on the screen that we're at the Federal Reserve Bank, and it's very moving 70s type music, making everything seem as if it's moving faster than it really is. And then we get a whole bunch of shots of everything being done in order to get this $1 million counted and delivered within 26 minutes. And they show some interesting things here. First of all, did you notice that they have like a shopping cart that someone's using to move things from one end of the building to the other.
Yeah, I did notice that.
It's,
Not sure if that's what they have in real life, but it's something everyone can identify with.
right.
Oh, that's a shopping cart.
That's right. Do you know when someone first introduced the idea of shopping carts?
Oh, I'm going to guess it's sometime in the early 20th century.
1937. It was
Oh, okay, that was close.
invented by a man named Sylvan Goldman, who was the owner of the Humpty Dumpty supermarket chain in Oklahoma. The year before, he was sitting in his office wondering how customers might be able to move their groceries, and he found a folding chair and put a basket on the seat and wheels on the legs, and they started playing around with it, and they eventually created something with a metal frame that held two wire baskets, and therefore he called them folding basket carriers because of the fact that he was using a folding chair. They ended up eventually they got a patent in 1940, and it was known as the folding basket carriage for self-service stores. And it was a no basket carrying plan. I guess before then, people were just had to like carry the basket in the hand type of thing. Goldman was also an innovator of pioneering self-serve stores, and this is just another part of that whole concept of what he wanted to do. Yeah, it's an interesting idea that, I mean, nowadays everyone uses shopping carts because it makes so much more sense to use it. And
A lot of people don't.
unless you're just going in for two items and end up coming out with 20, that type of thing.
A lot of people don't appreciate how expensive shopping carts are, which is why a lot of them have those wheel lock things if you push them too far. I
And
remember
also, and a lot of them have that you have to like put money in them in order to release it. And then you have to, in order to get your money back, you have to can they don't want people stealing the carts.
haven't seen that around here, but I'd heard about it. But yeah, I remember when I first heard that, and this was years ago, so God knows how expensive they are now, that one shopping cart was around $300. And this was years ago when I heard that. So shopping cart theft was a real problem. And so, I mean, it's one of those things that doesn't seem like it would be that expensive, but they really are. They really do cost a ton of money
Right.
for what they do.
So the
I thought shopping carts were best used in the movie Jackass. It always brings a smile to my face.
I'm not a fan of that movie at all. There are parts that are humorous, but but I
It's
understand what you're saying.
that movie is it's I have fond memories of watching that with my two daughters. They are definitely guilty pleasures. There's nothing remotely clever about them, but I mean, what can I say? They make me laugh.
Okay.
So,
So you're correct that there are carts that cost anywhere between $300 and $400. But most carts are anywhere between 75 and 150.
okay.
Quite often people do steal them. So there is over $800 million worldwide spent every year on creating security systems so that people don't steal shopping carts.
Wow.
You have a cart retrieval service which collects carts that are found on the store's premises and returns them to the store for a fee. The idea is that the stores are able to get their carts back in a timely manner. It costs a lot to have to replace them. There's also electronic and magnetic ones, which is what you were talking about before. It has a wheel clamp or a boot, And when it leaves a certain area, then it just stops and you can't move it from there. Which, obviously, works well.
It does work well. Sometimes too well.
That's right. There are places where you can't take the cart out of the store because they have like bars, some sort of physical impediment, like posts and stuff like that don't let you take them out.
Yeah.
They stopped using those in many jurisdictions because it also caused problems for people that were physically disabled, that they couldn't get through. Mm-hmm. They couldn't leave the store either. So a little bit of a problem. So the various names for a shopping cart are you have a grocery cart, shopping cart, supermarket cart, trolley, carriage, coo-hutter. In Scotland.
A what?
A coo-hutter. COOHUDDER.
Coo-hutter.
In New York and Hawaii, they're known as wagons. There are also places in eastern U.S., especially in Massachusetts, which is known as a wheel basket.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's the kind of shopping carts that they have there. And have you ever heard of the shopping cart theory?
No.
So it's an internet meme that started in order to try to see if people will steal a shopping cart or return it. It judges a person's ethics by whether they will return a shopping cart to its designated cart corral or deposit area. The concept became viral in 2020. Which posits that shopping carts possess a litmus test for a person's capability of self-control and governance, as well as a way to judge one's moral character. Detractors of the theory have cited various reasons why returning a cart is unfavorable, with concerns about leaving children unattended as one or more commonly referenced. So, what was the question that we were starting to ask?
I was just going to make a comment about how awesome I am for always returning the cart.
Well, again, here in Israel, because you have to pay, you have to put like a token in order to be able to take the cart. Mm-hmm. You will return the cart because you want to get your token back for the next time.
Mm-hmm.
We also see them using currency counter machines, which were probably mostly all familiar with seeing how they, how they count the various banknotes and coins and stuff like that. Coins you probably see more in like arcades and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You pour all the coins in mostly tokens, see what the whole thing is, and they have different types of sorters and stuff like that. What's interesting is that. They have machines now that can actually detect if the bills are counterfeit or not.
Of course.
They do it as a counter, mm-hmm. As it's counting. They, this one's fake or whatever it is. There are two types of designs. You have a back and top. The back ones are notes are fed into the hopper from the back of the machine. This feeding design makes the machine more cost efficient, but the notes need to be stacked mm-hmm. neatly to avoid jamming. And the maximum size of the stack is reduced. The top-loading one are fed into the hopper from the front of the machine, and the feeding design makes the machine more costly, but feeding notes is easier and is possible to feed notes continuously. I think what they show here more is the back-ended ones, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I remember correctly.
Yeah, I think so. So.
Because I guess those were a little more available at the time. Yeah, they show us. We only see it for a few seconds right at the end of this minute, but you still know that what they're doing here, and we get to see that they've got a whole bunch of $100 bills. That's the important thing. They have to count out 500,000 stacks of $100, and that's basically how this minute ends. So, is there anything else you wanted to mention about this minute or about the movie in general?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up David Shire's score. Because that's what I was going to talk about. This is really where the score just carries that scene and just makes everything so urgent. Mm-hmm. It's percussive with a little jazzy piano with it, kind of fitting with the money counting scene. And I actually own this soundtrack on vinyl. And that's one of my favorite tracks, is the one that's during the money counting scenes. And I'm glad it's on vinyl, because if I was listening to it in my car, I'd probably end up driving a lot faster, getting myself a ticket.
Okay, there is something to that.
But yeah,
I
it's a
can
great
understand.
album. Yeah,
Yes.
you know,
Yes.
if for people who like film scores, it's a great album. It's a good standalone piece of music.
I've seen places that mention it as in the top 10 movie soundtracks because of the way that it's so unique. I mean, I'm not someone who can dissect music and stuff like that, so I couldn't tell you exactly about that. Maybe my guest next week, who's a music expert, will be able to talk more about that. We'll have to see what he has to say about that. But I do love the score of this movie. I think it's great. All right, excellent. So every Friday we have a segment called Fun City Friday, where my guests will give their top five movies that take place in New York City. So start with your number five and work your way up, please.
Okay, this was actually the hardest one to come up with. Because there's so many places. I mean, there's so many movies that take place in New York. So I try to narrow it down to the one. I've never been to New York, so I try to narrow it down to the ones that kind of made me feel like I was there.
Okay.
And so number five is a movie called Q, The Winged Serpent, by director Larry Cohen. It's a monster movie about this flying serpent that's biting off people's heads, and it's hiding out in one of the skyscrapers. Larry Cohen to me is kind of a B movie national treasure. He made so many endearingly tacky films, most of them taking place in New York, sort of making him the Woody Allen of B movies, I guess. There's a lot of great use of New York locations in this one, and it's got a great performance by Michael Moriarty, and you really feel like he's a native New Yorker in this one. It's a funny movie, often intentionally. It's got some, pretty interesting scenes of violence in it, and great use of stop motion animation for the depiction of the creature. But it's definitely a New York movie. And I remember watching a movie about Larry Cohen. He was sharing this anecdote that this movie was being shot at the same time, I believe, Trading Places was. And there's a scene in Q where the police are shooting at the serpent that's flying around the Chrysler Building, and they're firing, blank ammo. But Cohen did not get permission to do that. And so apparently there were some people who thought that there was some shooting going on, and it was interrupt and it did interrupt the filming of Trading Places, apparently. That's one of my
Interesting.
favorite Coen stories. But it's a fun little movie. It's pure exploitation, but it's definitely a New York film. The next one is a film from 1948 called The Naked City, which is a terrific police procedural about a murder investigation. And it's got great narration. It kind of sets the scene about how New Yorkers wake up, how they go on with their day. This person's doing this, this person's doing that. And another one that goes all over the city following the inspector's investigation. I wouldn't go as far as to call it film noir, but it has a film noir aesthetic to it. Number three on my list is Dog Day Afternoon. Along with Taking a Pelham 123, this one gave me a real feel for being on the city streets, particularly the scenes with the crowd surrounding the bank. Kind of like, I don't know, maybe I'm re reading too much into this, but aside from Al Pacino's phenomenal performance, I got the impression that this is how New Yorkers would react in a standoff between bank robbers and the police. I hope I'm wrong, but probably not. Number two would be the French Connection. So far my movies don't really show New York in a positive light, and this one doesn't either. But I love the dark, gritty, almost claustrophobic feel of the New York locations in this film, particularly the scene where Gene Hackman's character Popeye Doyle is following what's his face around. The name escapes me now. The drug kingpin he's after. That's a terrific scene, and you see a lot of New York during that scene. And I'm pretty sure that it's not guerrilla filmmaking, not like the car chase scene was. And speaking of which, to me, that's still the greatest car chase in movie history. And the fact that it was,
Definitely makes sense.
yeah, and William Friedkin has said that they had one shot to do it, and they made the most of it. And number one is my least surprising pick, probably, is Taxi Driver. After Goodfellas, I think this is Martin Scorsese's best film. It's also his darkest. It shows parts of New York at its worst, and the narrator basically spends a lot of the movie going out and saying as such. And this is one of those movies where, each time I watch it, I see something different or something, that didn't stand out before. And his view of the city, as deranged as his mind is, the way he, views the people that are around him, it almost instills a little bit of sympathy in his character that he sees it as such a terrible place and that he's the one who can do something about it.
Very cool. All right, that is a great list. Thank you very much for that. So we will now once again play for the final time this season, the daily game of Name That Remake. So let's see if you can keep your streak going.
Okay.
Spin the wheel and see what you're gonna get. The original movie came out in 1963, and the remake came out in 1996. And it is about a young boy sent for the summer to stay by his eccentric uncle in Florida. And while he's there, he befriends a water mammal.
I'm assuming it's Flipper.
Yes, it is. All right. Very good. See, you did very well. You
Well, thank
are
you. I had
10 for
fun.
10 this month. This week.
What's
This,
that?
you are 10 for 10 this week. So nicely done.
Oh, good. Okay.
All right. Excellent. So, Dave, would you like to, for one final time this week, tell everyone where they can find you?
Yep, you can find me and all my musings and writings and reviews at FreeKittensMovieGuide.com.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. Find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So Dave, thank you very much for joining me. It was such a pleasure talking about this movie with you. I
I
hope
enjoyed
you
it.
enjoyed yourself.
This is the most I've ever talked about 5 minutes of a movie in my life.
There you go.
So it was
And think
fun.
of
It was
and it was
fun.
your number nine movie that you get to talk about. So there you go.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, excellent. So I will be back on Monday with a new guest, but until then, achoo.
Gesundheit.